Chapter 1. Three Lumps of Coal. 13th of January, 1946. The snow had been falling since noon, and Duncan Forrester brushed urgently at the stone bench to clear a space to sit down before the vertigo overcame him. The spinning sensation continued for a moment, but then silence began to seep in, and he felt his heart slow. The buildings around St. Mary the Virgin were mostly baroque, and the snow was piling deep on their window ledges. The church and its adjoining houses shut the churchyard off from the bustle of the city, and Forrester felt as if he was in a tiny clearing in a dense, silent wood. There were few cars in Oxford just after the war, and little fuel for them anyway, so that what noise there was mostly came from footsteps in the street beyond, and even they were muffled. As the snow came down and the light leaked out of the afternoon sky, he closed his eyes and waited for the demons to slip away into the gloom. He couldn't banish them. He'd tried that. He could only let the images rise to the surface unopposed. He felt the familiar waves of nausea, but he forced himself to ride them, reminding himself this was not reality, it would fade. He felt again the peculiar gliding sensation as the knife passed through the cartilage of the sentry's throat. He smelt the youth's skin as he gripped him, and then the warmth of the blood as it poured over his fingers, and the body slid down to his feet, looking up at him with mildly reproachful eyes. Forrester guessed he was about 17. As the sentry died, Forrester could see through the archway leading to the castle courtyard, SS guards taking the prisoners into the basement. There were many such images. He let them unreel at their own speed. He saw Barbara again, too, that last time at Waterloo Station, and the look in her eyes that made him think of Arctic winds blowing over the ice. He didn't see the man watching him from the tall, unlit window of the vicarage, but the watcher noticed the set of Forrester's shoulders and the tilt of his head, and long experience allowed him to infer the nature of the man's thoughts with some accuracy. For a long time, both of them were motionless, separated by no more than 50 yards of snow and lichened stone. Suddenly, from the archway that led to the street, Forrester heard the word Vintersolstant, followed by laughter, and then a brief babble of Swedish before the speakers passed on. There were students from all over Europe in Oxford now, a flood pent up by the war, released by the peace. They were not the high young voices of his own university years, but deeper, more mature. Many of the British undergraduates were ex-servicemen, their education postponed by the conflict. They too poured in, thirsty for knowledge. Duncan Forrester had graduated before the war began, and now, just months after the German surrender, he was back at Barnard College, junior research fellow in archaeology. But though he was still in his 20s, he felt bone-tired, as if he was an old man. He held out his hand and watched the snowflakes settle on it. As the heat of his body turned them to water, the drops rolled into his palm, forming a tiny pool. By the time he realized his hand was numb with cold, he was calm again. He paused for a moment, savoring the calm, and went through the ritual. He was alive. He was in one piece. The war was over. He was back in Oxford. He was free to pursue his research. Images of Barbara came and went, but all they evoked now was remembered pain, and deep behind that remembered joy, like a distant Eden. The man in the window watched as Forrester rose to his feet, shook the snow off him, tightened the belt of his British warm overcoat, headed back through the archway into the street, and disappeared. Only then did the watcher switch on the light inside the room, letting it spill over the empty churchyard like liquid gold. Moments later he closed the curtains, plunging the enclosure back into the afternoon half-light. Among the crowds in the street, Forrester felt almost normal again, just one among the many going to the shops on their way home from work. Not that there was much to buy, for this was austerity Britain, a victorious nation ruined by the struggle for victory. "Cadbury's milk chocolate is the best," proclaimed a poster, showing the familiar purple and gold wrapper so evocative of pre-war pleasures. Then, in smaller letters below, "Unfortunately, we are only allowed enough milk to make extremely small quantities of our famous product, so if you are lucky enough to get some, do save it for the children." But Forrester, who had not seen a piece of chocolate for at least a year, knew no children to save it for.